Disc 3. George picked up one of the papers. It was made of thick parchment, quite yellow with age. She spread it out on the sand and looked at it. The others glanced at it too, but they couldn't make out what it was at all. It seemed to be a kind of map. "Perhaps it's a map of some place he had to go to," said Julian. But suddenly, George's hands began to shake as she held the map, and her eyes gleamed brilliantly as she looked up at the others. She opened her mouth, but didn't speak.
"What's the matter?" said Julian curiously. "What's up? Have you lost your tongue?"
George shook her head, and then began to speak with a rush.
"Julian, do you know what this is? It's a map of my old castle, of Kirin Castle, when it wasn't a ruin. And it shows the dungeons. And look, just look what's written in this corner of the dungeons."
She put a trembling finger on one part of the map. The others leaned over to see what it was, and printed in old-fashioned letters was a curious word, ingots.
"Ingots?" said Anne, puzzled. "What does that mean? I've never heard that word before."
But the two boys had.
"Ingots!" cried Dick. "Why, that must be the bars of gold. They were called ingots."
"Most bars of metal are called ingots," said Julian, going red with excitement. "But as we know there is gold missing from that ship, then it really looks as if ingots here meant bars of gold. Oh, golly, to think they may still be hidden somewhere under Kirin Castle. George!"
"The castle is in ruins now and so overgrown. But somehow or other, we'll find those ingots. What a lovely word. Ingots. Ingots. Ingots!"
It sounded somehow more exciting than the word gold. Nobody spoke about gold anymore. They talked about the ingots. Tim couldn't make out what the excitement was at all. He wagged his tail and tried hard to lick first one and then another of the children. But for once, in a way, not one of them paid any attention to him. He simply couldn't understand it. And after a while, he went and sat down by himself with his back to the children and his ears down.
"Oh, do look at poor Timothy," said George. "He can't understand our excitement. Tim, Tim, darling, it's all right. You're not in disgrace or anything." "Oh, Tim, we've got the most wonderful secret in the whole world."
Tim bounded up, his tail wagging, pleased to be taken notice of once more. He put his big paw on the precious map, and the four children shouted at him at once.
"Golly, we can't have that torn," said Julian.
Then he looked at the others and frowned.
"What are we going to do about the box?" he said. "I mean, George's father will be sure to miss it, won't he? We'll have to give it back."
"Well, can't we take out the map and keep it?" said Dick. "He won't know it was there if he hasn't looked in the box. And it's pretty certain he hasn't. The other things don't matter much. They're only that old diary and a few letters."
"To be on the safe side, let's take a copy of the map," said Julian. "Then we can put the real map back and replace the box."
They all voted that a very good idea. They went back to Kirin Cottage and traced out the map carefully. They did it in the tool shed because they didn't want anyone to see them. It was a queer map. It was in three parts.
"This part shows the dungeons under the castle," said Julian. "And this shows a plan of the ground floor of the castle. And this shows the top part. My word, it was a fine place in those days. The dungeons run all under the castle. I bet they were pretty awful places. I wonder how people got down to them."
"We'll have to study the map a bit more and see," said George. "It all looks rather muddled to us at present, but once we take the map over to the castle and study it there, we may be able to make out how to get down to the hidden dungeons."
"Oh, I don't expect any children ever had such an adventure as this."
Julian put the traced map carefully into his jeans pocket. He didn't mean it to leave him. It was very precious. Then he put the real map back into the box and looked towards the house. "What about putting it back now?" he said. "Maybe your father is still asleep, George." But he wasn't. He was awake. Luckily, he hadn't missed the box. He came into the dining room to have tea with the family, and Julian took his chance. He muttered an excuse, slipped away from the table, and replaced the box on the table behind his uncle's chair. He winked at the others when he came back. They felt relieved. They were all scared of Uncle Quentin, and were not at all anxious to be in his bad books. Anne didn't say one word during the whole of the meal. She was so terribly afraid she might give something away, either about Tim or the box. The others spoke very little too. While they were at tea, the telephone rang, and Aunt Fanny went to answer it. She soon came back. "It's for you, Quentin," she said. "Apparently, the old wreck has caused quite a lot of excitement, and there are men from a London paper who want to ask you questions about it."
"Tell them I'll see them at 6, said Uncle Quentin.
The children looked at one another in alarm. They hoped that their uncle wouldn't show the box to the newspaper men. Then the secret of the hidden gold might come out.
"What a mercy we took a tracing of the map," said Julian after tea. "But I'm jolly sorry now we left the real map in the box. Someone else may guess our secret."
Chapter 10. An Astonishing Offer. The next morning, the papers were full of the extraordinary way in which the old wreck had been thrown up out of the sea. The newspaper men had got out of the children's uncle the tale of the wreck and the lost gold, and some of them even managed to land on Kirin Island and take pictures of the old ruined castle. George was furious.
"It's my castle," she stormed to her mother. "It's my island. You said it could be mine. You did. You did."
"I know, George, dear," said her mother, "but you really must be sensible. It can't hurt the island to be landed on, and it can't hurt the castle to be photographed."
"But I don't want it to be," said George,
her face dark and sulky.
"It's mine. And the wreck is mine. You said so."
"Well, I didn't know it was going to be thrown up like that," said her mother.
"Oh, do be sensible, George. What can it possibly matter if people go to look at the wreck? You can't stop them."
George couldn't stop them, but that didn't make her any less angry about it. The children were astonished at the interest that the cast-up wreck caused. And because of that, Kirin Island became an object of great interest too. Sightseers from the places all around came to see it, and the fishermen managed to find the little inlet and land the people there. George sobbed with rage, and Julian tried to comfort her.
"Listen, George, no one knows our secret yet. We'll wait till this excitement has died down, and then we'll go to Kirin Castle and find the ingots."
"If someone doesn't find them first," said George, drying her eyes. She was furious with herself for crying, but she really couldn't help it.
"How could they?" said Julian. "No one has seen inside the box yet. I'm going to wait my chance and get that map out before anyone sees it."
But he didn't have a chance because something dreadful happened. Uncle Quentin sold the old box to a man who bought antique things. He came out from his study, beaming, a day or two after the excitement began, and told Aunt Fanny and the children.
"I've struck a very good bargain with that man," he said to his wife. "You know that old tin-lined box from the wreck? Well, this fellow collects curious things like that, and he gave me a very good price for it. Very good indeed. More even than I could expect for the writing of my book. As soon as he saw the old map there and the old diary, he said at once that he would buy the whole collection."
The children stared at him in horror.
The box was sold.
Now someone would study the map and perhaps jump to what ingots meant. The story of the lost gold had been put into all the newspapers now. Nobody could fail to know what the map showed if they studied it carefully. The children did not dare to tell Uncle Quentin what they knew. It was true he was all smiles now and was promising to buy them new shrimping nets and a raft for themselves. But he was such a changeable person. He might fly into a furious temper if he heard that Julian had taken the box and opened it himself while his uncle was sleeping. When they were alone, the children discussed the whole matter. It seemed very serious indeed to them. They half wondered if they should let Aunt Fanny into the secret. But it was such a precious secret and so marvellous that they felt they didn't want to give it away to anyone at all. "Now, listen," said Julian at last. "We'll ask Aunt Fanny if we can go to Kirin Island and spend a day or two there. Sleep there at night too, I mean. That will give us a little time to poke round and see what we can find. The sightseers won't come after a day or two, I'm sure. Maybe we'll get in before anyone tumbles to our secret. After all, the man who bought the box may not even guess that the map shows Kirin Castle." They felt more cheerful. It was so awful to do nothing. As soon as they had planned to act, they felt better. They decided to ask their aunt the next day if they might go and spend the weekend at the castle. The weather was gloriously fine, and it would be great fun. They could take plenty of food with them. When they went to ask Aunt Fanny, Uncle Quentin was with her. He was all smiles again, and even clapped Julian on the back.
"Well," he said, "what's this deputation for?"
We just wanted to ask Aunt Fanny something," said Julian politely. Aunt Fanny, as the weather is so fine, do you think you would let us go for the weekend to Kirin Castle, please, and spend a day or two there on the island? You can't think how we would love to."
"Well, what do you think, Quentin?" asked their aunt, turning to her husband.
"If they want to, they can," said Uncle Quentin. "They won't have a chance too soon. My dears, we have had a marvellous offer for Kirin Island. A man wants to buy it, rebuild the castle as a hotel, and make it into a proper holiday place. What do you think of that?"
All four children stared at the smiling man, shocked and horrified.
You can't sell my castle! I won't let them be sold!"
Her father frowned.
"Don't be silly, Georgina," he said. "It isn't really yours. You know that. It belongs to your mother, and naturally she would like to sell it if she could. We need the money very badly. You will be able to have a great many nice things once we sell the island."
"I don't want nice things," cried poor George. "My castle and my island are the nicest things I could ever have. Mother, Mother, you know you said I could have them. You know you did. I believed you."
"George, dear, I did mean you to have them to play on when I thought they couldn't possibly be worth anything," said her mother, looking distressed. "But now things are different. Your father has been offered quite a good sum, far more than we ever thought of getting, and we really can't afford to turn it down."
"So you only gave me the island when you thought it wasn't worth anything," said George, her face white and angry. "As soon as it is worth money, you take it away again. I think that's horrid. It isn't honourable."
"That's enough, Georgina," said her father angrily. "Your mother is guided by me. You're only a child. Your mother didn't really mean what she said. It was only to please you. But you know well enough you will share in the money we get and have anything you want."
"I won't touch a penny," said George, in a low, choking voice. "You'll be sorry you sold it."
The girl turned and stumbled out of the room. The others felt very sorry for her. They knew what she was feeling. She took things so very seriously. Julian thought she didn't understand grown-ups very well. It wasn't a bit of good fighting grown-ups. They could do exactly as they liked.
If they wanted to take away George's island and castle, they could. If they wanted to sell it, they could. But what Uncle Quentin didn't know was the fact that there might be a store of gold ingots there. Julian stared at his uncle and wondered whether to warn him. Then he decided not to. There was just a chance that the four children could find the gold first.
"When are you selling the island, Uncle?" he asked quietly.
"The deeds will be signed in about a week's time," was the answer. "So if you really want to spend a day or two there, you'd better do so quickly. For after that, you may not get permission from the new owners."
"Was it the man who bought the old box who wants to buy the island?" asked Julian.
"Yes," said his uncle. "I was a little surprised myself, for I thought he was just a buyer of old things. It was astonishing to me that he should get the idea of buying the island to rebuild the castle as a hotel. Still, I dare say there will be big money in running a hotel there. Very romantic, staying on a little island like that. People will like it. I'm no businessman myself, and I certainly shouldn't care to invest my money in a place like Kirin Island, but I should think he knows what he is doing all right."
"Yes, he certainly does," thought Julian to himself, as he went out of the room with Dick and Anne. "He's read that map and has jumped to the same idea that we did. The store of hidden ingots is somewhere on that island, and he's going to get it. He doesn't want to build a hotel. He's after the treasure. I expect he's offered Uncle Quentin some silly low price that poor old uncle thinks is marvellous. Oh, dear, this is a horrible thing to happen."
He went to find George. She was in the tool shed, looking quite green. She said she felt sick.
"It's only because you're so upset," said Julian.
He slipped his arm round her. For once, George didn't push it away. She felt comforted. Tears came into her eyes, and she angrily tried to blink them away.
"Listen, George," said Julian. "We mustn't give up hope. We'll go to Kirin Island tomorrow, and we'll do our very, very best to get down into the dungeon somehow and find the ingots. We'll jolly well stay there till we do. See? Now cheer up, because we'll want your help in planning everything. Thank goodness we took a tracing of the map."
George cheered up a little. She still felt angry with her father and mother, but the thought of going to Kirin Island for a day or two and taking Timothy too certainly seemed rather good.
"I do think my father and mother are unkind," she said.
"Well, they're not really," said Julian wisely. "After all, if they need money badly, they would be silly not to part with something they think is quite useless. As you know, your father did say you could have anything you want. I know what I would ask for if I were you."
"What?" asked George.
"Timothy, of course," said Julian.
And that made George smile and cheer up tremendously. Chapter 11. Off to Kirin Island. Julian and George went to find Dick and Anne. They were waiting for them in the garden, looking rather upset. They were glad to see Julian and George and ran to meet them. Anne took George's hands.
"I'm awfully sorry about your island, George," she said.
"So am I," said Dick. "Bad luck, old girl. I mean, old boy."
George managed to smile.
"I've been behaving like a girl," she said, half ashamed. "But I did get an awful shock."
Julian told the others what they had planned.
"We'll go tomorrow morning," he said. "We'll make out a list of all the things we shall need. Let's begin now."
He took out a pencil and notebook. The others looked at him.
"Things to eat and drink."
He looked at the others.
"Spades," he said solemnly, and scribbled the word down.
Anne stared in surprise.
"What for?"
she asked.
"Well, we'll want to dig about when we're hunting for a way down to the dungeons," said Julian.
"Ropes," said Dick. "We may want those too."
"And torches," said George. "It'll be dark in the dungeons."
Ooh, said Anne, feeling a pleasant shiver go down her back at the thought. She had no idea what dungeons were like, but they sounded thrilling.
Rugs, said Dick. We'll be cold at night if we sleep in that little old room.
Julian wrote them down. Mugs to drink from, he said. And we'll take a few tools, too. We may perhaps need them. You never know. At the end of half an hour, they had quite a nice long list, and everyone felt pleased and excited. George was beginning to recover from her rage and disappointment. If she had been alone and had brooded over everything, she would have been in an even worse sulken temper. But somehow the others were so calm and sensible and cheerful. It was impossible to sulk for long if she was with them.
I think I'd have been much nicer if I hadn't been on my own so much, thought George to herself, as she looked at Julian's bent head. Talking about things to other people does help a lot. They don't seem so dreadful then. They seem more bearable and ordinary. I like my three cousins awfully. I like them because they talk and laugh and are always cheerful and kind. I wish I was like them. I'm sulky and bad-tempered and fierce, and no wonder Father doesn't like me and scolds me so often. Mother's a dear, but I understand now why she says I'm difficult. I'm different from my cousins. They're easy to understand, and everyone likes them. Oh, I'm glad they came. They are making me more like I ought to be.
This was a long thought to think, and George looked very serious while she was thinking it. Julian looked up and caught her blue eyes fixed on him. He smiled.
Penny for your thoughts, he said.
They're not worth a penny, said George, going red. I was just thinking how nice you all are, and how I wished I could be like you.
You are an awfully nice person, said Julian, surprisingly. You can't help being an only child. They're always a bit queer, you know, unless they're mighty careful. You're a most interesting person, I think.
George flushed every single word they said.
He must feel pleased to think he's going to be with us for 2 or 3 days, said Anne.
It was very exciting the next morning, setting off in the boat with all their things packed neatly at one end. Julian checked them all by reading out aloud from his list. It didn't seem as if they had forgotten anything.
Got the map? Said Dick suddenly.
Julian nodded.
I put on clean jeans this morning, he said, but you may be sure I remembered to pop the map into my pocket. Here it is.
He took it out, and the wind at once blew it right out of his hands. It fell into the sea and bobbed there in the wind. All four children gave a cry of utter dismay.
Their precious map!
Quick, row after it!
Cried George, and swung the boat round. But someone was quicker than she was. Tim had seen the paper fly from Julian's hand, and had heard and understood the cries of dismay. With an enormous splash, he leapt into the water and swam valiantly after the map. He could swim well for a dog, but he was strong and powerful. He soon had the map in his mouth and was swimming back to the boat. The children thought he was simply marvellous. George hauled him into the boat and took the map from his mouth. There was hardly the mark of his teeth on it. He had carried it so carefully. It was wet, and the children looked anxiously at it to see if the tracing had been spoilt. But Julian had traced it very strongly, and it was quite all right. He placed it on a seat to dry and told Dick to hold it there in the sun.
Phew, that was a narrow squeak, he said,
and the others agreed. George took the oars again, and they set off once more to the island, getting a perfect shower bath from Timothy when he stood up and shook his wet coat. He was given a big biscuit as a reward and crunched it up with great enjoyment. George made her way through the reefs of rocks with a sure hand. It was marvellous to the others how she could slide the boat in between the dangerous rocks and never get a scratch. They thought she was really wonderful. She brought them safely to the little inlet,
and they jumped out onto the sand. They pulled the boat high up, in case the tide came far up the tiny cove, and then began to unload their goods.
"We'll carry all the things to that little stone room," said Julian. "They will be safe there and won't get wet if it rains. I hope nobody comes to the island while we are here, George."
"I shouldn't think they would," said George. "Father said it would be about a week before the deeds were signed, making over the island to that man. It won't be his till then. We've got a week anyhow."
"Well, we don't need to keep a watch in case anyone else arrives then," said Julian, who had half thought that it would be a good idea to make someone stay on guard at the inlet, to give a warning to the others in case anyone else arrived.
"Come on, you take the spades, Dick. I'll take the food and drink with George, and Anne can take the little things."
The food and drink were in a big box, but the children did not mean to starve while they were on the island. They had brought loaves of bread, butter, biscuits, jam, tins of fruit, ripe plums, bottles of ginger beer, a kettle to make tea, and anything else they could think of. George and Julian staggered up the cliff with a heavy box. They had to put it down once or twice to give themselves a rest. They put everything into the little room. Then they went back to get the collection of blankets and rugs from the boat. They arranged them in the corners of the little room and thought that it would be most exciting to spend the night there.
"The two girls can sleep together on this pile of rugs," said Julian, "and we two boys will have this pile."
George looked as if she didn't want to be put with Anne and classed as a girl. But Anne didn't wish to sleep alone in her corner, and she looked so beseechingly at George that the bigger girl smiled at her and made no objection. Anne thought that George was getting nicer and nicer.
"Well, now we'll get down to business," said Julian, and he pulled out his map. "We must study this really carefully and find out exactly under what spot the entrances to the dungeons are. Now, come around and let's do our best to find out. It's up to us to use our brains and beat that man who's bought the island."
They all bent over the traced map. It was quite dry now, and the children looked at it earnestly. It was plain that in the old days the castle had been a very fine place.
"Now, look," said Julian, putting his finger on the plan of the dungeons. "These seem to run all along under the castle, and here and here are the marks that seem to be meant to represent steps or stairs."
"Yes," said George. "I should think they are. Well, if so, they appear to be two ways of getting down into the dungeons. One lot of steps seems to begin somewhere near this little room, and the other seems to start under the tower there. And what do you...
There was an old well somewhere, do you remember?"
"Well, that may be it, I should think. It would have to be very deep to get fresh water right under the sea, so it probably goes down through the dungeons too. Isn't this thrilling?"
Everyone thought it was. They felt happy and excited. There was something to discover, something they could and must discover within the next day or two. They looked at one another.
"Well," said Dick, "what are we going to start on? Shall we try to find the entrance to the dungeons, the one that seems to start round about this little room? For all we know, there may be a big stone we can lift that opens above the dungeon steps."
This was a thrilling thought, and the children jumped up at once. Julian folded up the precious map and put it into his pocket. He looked round. The stone floor of the little room was overgrown with creeping weeds. They must be cleared away before it was possible to see if there were any stones that looked as if they might be moved.
"We'd better set to work," said Julian, and he picked up a spade. "Let's clear away these weeds with our spades. Scrape them off, look, like this, and then examine every single stone."
They all picked up spades, and soon the little stone room was full of a scraping sound as the four of them chiselled away at the close-growing weeds with their spades. It wasn't very difficult to get the stones clear of them, and the children worked with a will. Tim got most excited about everything. He hadn't any idea at all what they were doing, but he joined in valiantly. He scraped away at the floor with his four paws, sending earth and plants flying high into the air.
"Hi, Tim," said Julian, shaking a clod of earth out of his hair. "You're being a bit too vigorous. My word, you'll send the stones flying into the air too in a minute. George, isn't..."
Soon, the stones of the little room were clear of earth, sand and weeds. The children saw that they were all the same size, big and square, fitted well together. They went over them carefully with their torches, trying to find one that might move or lift.
"We should probably find one with an iron ring handle sunk into it," said Julian.
But they didn't. All the stones looked exactly the same. It was most disappointing. Julian tried inserting his spade into the cracks between the various stones to see if by any chance he could move one. But they couldn't be moved. It seemed as if they were all set in the solid ground. After about 3 hours' hard work, the children sat down to eat a meal. They were very hungry indeed, and felt glad to think there were so many things to eat. As they ate, they discussed the problem they were trying to solve.
"It looks as if the entrance to the dungeons was not under this little room after all," said Julian. "It's disappointing, but somehow I don't think now that the steps down to the dungeon started from here. Let's measure the map and see if we can make out exactly where the steps do start. It may be, of course, that the measurements aren't correct and won't be any help to us at all, but we can try."
So they measured as best they could to try and find out in exactly what place the dungeon steps seemed to begin. It was impossible to tell, for the plans of the three floors seemed to be done to different scales. Julian stared at the map, puzzled. It seemed rather hopeless. Surely they wouldn't have to hunt all over the ground floor of the castle. It would take ages.
"Look," said George, suddenly, putting her finger on the hole that they all thought must be meant to represent the well.
"The entrance to the dungeons seems to be not very far off the well. If only we could find the well, we could hunt around a bit for the beginning of the dungeon steps. The well is shown in both maps. It seems to be somewhere about the middle of the castle."
"That's a good idea of yours," said Julian, pleased. "Let's go out into the middle of the castle. We can more or less guess where the old well ought to be, because it definitely seems to be about the middle of the old yard out there."
Out they all went into the sunshine. They felt very important and serious. It was marvellous to be looking for lost ingots of gold. They all felt perfectly certain that they really were somewhere beneath their feet. It didn't occur to any of the children that the treasure might not be there. They stood in the ruined courtyard that had once been the centre of the castle. They paced out the middle of the yard and then stood there, looking around in vain for anything that might perhaps have been the opening of an old well. It was all so overgrown. Sand had blown in from the shore, and weeds and bushes of all kinds grew there. The stones that had once formed the floor of the big courtyard were now cracked and were no longer lying flat. Most of them were covered with sand or weeds.
"Look, there's a rabbit," cried Dick,
as a big sandy rabbit lolloped slowly across the yard. It disappeared into a hole on the other side. Then another rabbit appeared, sat up and looked at the children, and then vanished too. The children were thrilled. They had never seen such tame rabbits before. A third rabbit appeared. It was a small one with absurdly big ears and the tiniest white bob of a tail. It didn't even look at the children. It bounded about in a playful way, and then, to the children's enormous delight, it sat up on its hind legs and began to wash its big ears, pulling down first one and then the other. But this was too much for Timothy.
He had watched the other two bound across the yard and then disappear without so much as barking at them. But to see this youngster actually sitting there washing its ears under his very nose was really too much for any dog. He gave an excited yelp and rushed full tilt at the surprised rabbit. For a moment, the little thing didn't move. It had never been frightened or chased before, and it stared with big eyes at the rushing dog. Then it turned itself about and tore off at top speed, its white bobtail going up and down as it bounded away. It disappeared under a gorse bush near the children. Timothy went after it, vanishing under the big bush too. Then a shower of sand and earth was thrown up as Tim tried to go down the hole after the rabbit and scraped and scrabbled with his strong front paws as fast as he could. He yelped and whined in excitement, not seeming to hear George's voice calling to him. He meant to get that rabbit. He went almost mad as he scraped at the hole, making it bigger and bigger.
"Tim, do you hear me? Come out of there!" shouted George. "You're not to chase the rabbits here. You know you mustn't. You're very naughty. Come out!"
But Tim didn't come out. He just went on and on, scraping away madly. George went to fetch him. Just as she got up to the gorse bush, the scraping suddenly stopped. There came a scared yelp, and no more noise was heard. George peered under the prickly bush in astonishment. Tim had disappeared. He just simply wasn't there anymore. There was the big rabbit hole, made enormous by Tim, but there was no Tim.
"I say, Julian, Tim's gone," said George in a scared voice. "He surely can't have gone down the rabbit's hole, can he? I mean, he's such a big dog."
The children crowded round the big gorse bush. There came the sound of a muffled whine from somewhere down it. Julian looked astonished.
"He is down the hole," he said. "How queer! I never heard of a dog really going down a rabbit hole before. However are we going to get him out?"
"We'll have to dig up the gorse bush to begin with," said George in a determined voice. She would have dug up the whole of Kirin Castle to get Tim back, that was certain.
"I can't have poor old Tim whining for help down there and not do what we can to help him."
The bush was far too big and prickly to creep underneath. Julian was glad they had brought tools of all kinds. He went to fetch an axe. They had brought a small one with them, and it would do to chop away the prickly branches and trunk of the gorse bush. The children slashed at it, and soon the poor bush began to look a sorry sight. It took a long time to destroy it, for it was prickly, sturdy and stout. Every child's hands were scratched by the time the bush had been reduced to a mere stump. Then they could see the hole quite well. Julian shone his torch down it. He gave a shout of surprise.
"I know what's happened. The old well is here. The rabbits had a hole at the side of it, and Tim scraped away to make it bigger and uncovered a bit of the well hole, and he's fallen down the well."
"Oh, no, oh, no," cried George in panic. "Oh, Tim, Tim, are you all right?"
A distant whine came to their ears. Evidently, Tim was there somewhere. The children looked at one another.
"Well, there's only one thing to do," said Julian. "We must get out spades now and dig out the hole of the well. Then, maybe, we can let a rope down or something and get Tim."
They set to work with their spades. It was not really difficult to uncover the hole, which had been blocked only by the spreading roots of the big gorse bush, some fallen masonry, earth, sand and small stones. Apparently, a big slab had fallen from part of the tower across the well hole and partly closed it. The weather and the growing gorse bush had done the rest. It took all the children and then the children could see down the well hole. It was very deep and very dark. They could not possibly see the bottom. Julian took a stone and dropped it down. They all listened for the splash. But there was no splash. Either there was no longer any water there, or the well was too deep even to hear the splash.
I think it's too deep for us to hear anything, said Julian. Now, where's Tim?
He shone his torch down, and there was Tim. Many years before, a big slab had fallen down the well itself and had stuck a little way down across the well hole. And on this old cracked slab sat Tim, his big eyes staring up in fright. He simply could not imagine what had happened to him. There was an old iron ladder fastened to the side of the well. George was on it before anyone else could get there. Down she went, not caring if the ladder held or not, and reached Tim. Somehow she got him onto her shoulder, and holding him there with one hand, she climbed slowly up again. The other three hauled her out, and Tim jumped round her, barking and licking for all he was worth.
"Well, Tim," said Dick, "you shouldn't chase rabbits, but you've certainly done us a good turn, because you found the well for us. Now we've only got to look around a little to find the dungeon entrance."
They set to work again to hunt for the dungeon entrance. They dug about with their spades under all the bushes. They pulled up crooked stones and dug their spades into the earth below, hoping that they might suddenly find them going through into space. It was really very thrilling. And then Anne found the entrance. It was quite by accident. She was tired and sat down to rest. She lay on her front and scrabbled about in the sand. Suddenly, her fingers touched something hard and cold in the sand. She uncovered it, and lo and behold, it was an iron ring. She gave a shout, and the others looked up.
"There's a stone with an iron ring in it here!"
yelled Anne excitedly. They all rushed over to her. Julian dug about with his spade and uncovered the whole stone. Sure enough, it did have a ring in it, and rings are only let into stones that need to be moved. Surely this stone must be the one that covered the dungeon entrance. All the children took turns at pulling on the iron ring, but the stone did not move. Then Julian tied two or three turns of rope through it, and the four children put out their full strength and pulled for all they were worth. The stone moved. The children distinctly felt it stir.
"All together again!" cried Julian. And all together they pulled.
The stone stirred again and then suddenly gave way. It moved upwards and the children fell over on top of one another like a row of dominoes suddenly pushed down. Tim darted to the hole and barked madly down it as if all the rabbits of the world lived there. Julian and George shot to their feet and rushed to the opening that the moved stone had disclosed. They stood there, looking downwards, their faces shining with delight. They had found the entrance to the dungeons. A steep flight of steps, cut out of the rock itself, led downwards into deep darkness.
"Come on," cried Julian, snapping on his torch. "We've found what we wanted. Now for the dungeons."
The steps down were slippery. Tim darted down first, lost his foothold, and rolled down five or six steps, yelping with fright. Julian went after him, then George, then Dick, and then Anne. They were all tremendously thrilled. Indeed, they quite expected to see piles of gold and all kinds of treasure everywhere around them. It was dark down the steep flight of steps and smelt very musty. Anne choked a little.
"I hope the air down here is all right," said Julian. "Sometimes it isn't good in these underground places. If anyone feels a bit funny, they'd better say so and we'll go up into the open air again."
But however funny they might feel, nobody would have said so. It was all far too exciting to worry about feeling queer. The steps went down a long way. Then they came to an end. Julian stepped down from the last rock stair and flashed his torch around. It was a weird sight that met his eyes. The dungeons of Kirin Castle were made out of the rock itself. Whether there were natural caves there, or whether they had been hollowed out by man, the children could not tell. But certainly they were very mysterious, dark and full of echoing sounds. When Julian gave a sigh of excitement, it fled into the rocky hollows and swelled out and echoed around as if it were a live thing. It gave all the children a very queer feeling.
"Isn't it strange?" said George in a low voice.
At once the echoes took up her words and multiplied them and made them louder, and all the dungeon caves gave back the girl's words over and over again.
"Isn't it strange? Isn't it strange? Isn't it strange?"
Anne slipped her hand into Dick's. She felt scared. She didn't like the echoes at all. She knew they were only echoes, but they did sound exactly like the voices of scores of people hidden in the caves.
"Where do you suppose the ingots are?" said Dick.
And at once the caves threw him back his words. "Ingots, ingots are, ingots are, are, are." Julian laughed, and his laugh was split up into dozens of different laughs that came out of the dungeons and spun round the listening children. It really was the queerest thing.
"Come on," said Julian. "Maybe the echoes won't be so bad a little farther in."
"Farther in," said the echoes at once. "Farther in." They moved away from the end of the rocky steps and explored the nearby dungeons. They were really only rocky cellars stretching under the castle. Maybe wretched prisoners had been kept there many, many years before, but mostly they had been used for storing things.
"I wonder which dungeon was used for storing the ingots," said Julian.
He stopped and took the map out of his pocket. He flashed his torch on it. But although it showed him quite plainly the dungeon where ingots were marked, he had no idea at all of the right direction.
"I say, look, there's a door here shutting off the next dungeon," suddenly cried Dick. "I bet this is the dungeon we're looking for. I bet there are ingots in here."
Chapter 13. Down in the Dungeons. Four torches were flashed onto the wooden door. It was big and stout, studded with great iron nails. Julian gave a whoop of delight and rushed to it. He felt certain that behind it was the dungeon used for storing things. But the door was fast shut. No amount of pushing or pulling would open it. It had a great keyhole, but no key there. The four children stared in exasperation at the door. Bother it! Just as they really thought they were near the ingots, this door wouldn't open.
"We'll fetch the axe," said Julian suddenly. "We may be able to chop round the keyhole and smash the lock."
"That's a good idea," said George, delighted. "Come on back."
They left the big door and tried to get back the way they had come. But the dungeons were so big and so rambling that they lost their way. They stumbled over old broken barrels, rotting wood, empty bottles, and many other things as they tried to find their way back to the big flight of rock steps.
"This is sickening," said Julian at last. "I simply haven't any idea at all where the entrance is. We keep on going into one dungeon after another, and one passage after another, and they all seem to be exactly the same, dark and smelly and mysterious.
Suppose we have to stay here all the rest of our lives," said Anne gloomily.
"Idiot," said Dick, taking her hand. "We shall soon find the way out. Hello, what's this?"
They all stopped. They had come to what looked like a chimney shaft of brick stretching down from the roof of the dungeon to the floor. Julian flashed his torch onto it. He was puzzled.
"I know what it is," said George suddenly. "It's the well, of course. You remember it was shown in the plan of the dungeons as well as in the plan of the ground floor?"
Well, that's the shaft of the well going down and down. I wonder if there's any opening in it just here so that water could be taken into the dungeons as well as up to the ground floor. They went to see. On the other side of the well shaft was a small opening big enough for one child at a time to put his head and shoulders through and look down. They shone their torches down and up. The well was so deep that it was still impossible to see the bottom of it. Julian dropped a stone down again, but there was no sound of either a thud or a splash. He looked upwards and could see the faint gleam of daylight that slid round the broken slab of stone lying a little way down the shaft, the slab on which Tim had sat waiting to be rescued.
"Yes," he said, "this is the well all right. Isn't it queer? Well, now we've found the well, we know that the entrance to the dungeons isn't very far off."
That cheered them all up tremendously. They took hands and hunted around in the dark, their torches making bright beams of light here and there. Anne gave a screech of excitement.
"Here's the entrance! It must be, because I can see faint daylight coming down."
The children rounded a corner, and sure enough, there was the steep, rocky flight of steps leading upwards. Julian took a quick look round so that he might know the way to go when they came down again. He didn't feel at all certain that he would find the wooden door. They all went up into the sunshine. It was delicious to feel the warmth on their heads and shoulders after the cold air down in the dungeons. Julian looked at his watch and gave a loud exclamation.
"It's 6:30! Half past six! No wonder I feel hungry. We haven't had any tea. We've been working and wandering about those dungeons for hours.
Well, let's have a kind of tea supper before we do anything else," said Dick. "I don't feel as if I've had anything to eat for about 12 months.
"Well, considering you ate about twice as much as anyone else at dinner time," began Julian indignantly. Then he grinned. "I feel the same as you," he said. "Come on, let's get a really good meal. George, what about boiling a kettle and making some cocoa or something? I feel cold after all that time underground."
It was fun boiling the kettle on a fire of dry sticks. It was lovely to lie about in the warmth of the evening sun and munch bread and cheese and enjoy cake and biscuits. They all enjoyed themselves thoroughly. Tim had a good meal too. He hadn't very much liked being underground, and had followed the others very closely indeed, his tail well down. He had been very frightened, too, of the curious echoes here and there. Once he had barked, and it had seemed to Tim as if the whole of the dungeons were full of other dogs, all barking far more loudly than he could. He hadn't even dared to whine after that. But now he was happy again, eating the titbits that the children gave him and licking George whenever he was near her. It was past 8 o'clock by the time that the children had finished their meal and tidied up. Julian looked at the others. The sun was sinking and the day was no longer so warm.
"Well," he said, "I don't know what you feel, but I don't somehow want to go down into those dungeons again today, not even for the sake of smashing in that door with the axe and opening it. I'm tired, and I don't like the thought of losing my way in those dungeons at night."
The others heartily agreed with him, especially Anne, who had secretly been dreading going down again with the night coming on. The little girl was almost asleep. She was so tired out with hard work and excitement.
"Come on, Anne," said George,
and crept in with George and Anne. He lay down on them and felt so heavy that Anne had to push him off her legs. He sat himself down on her again, and she groaned half asleep. Tim wagged his tail and thumped it hard against her ankles. Then George pulled him onto her own legs and lay there, feeling him breathe. She was very happy. She was spending the night on her island. They had almost found the ingots, she was sure. She had Tim with her, actually sleeping on her rugs. Perhaps everything would come right after all, somehow.
She fell asleep. The children felt perfectly safe with Tim on guard. They slept peacefully until the morning, when Tim saw a rabbit through the broken archway leading to the little room and sped away to chase it. He awoke George as he got up from the rugs, and she sat up and rubbed her eyes.
"Wake up!" she cried to the others. "Wake up, all of you! It's morning, and we're on the island!"
They all awoke. It was really thrilling to sit up and remember everything. Julian thought of the big wooden door at once. He would soon smash it in with his axe, he felt sure. And then what would they find? They had breakfast and ate just as much as ever. Then Julian picked up the axe they had brought and took everyone to the flight of steps. Tim went too, wagging his tail, but not really feeling very pleased at the thought of going down into the queer places where other dogs seemed to bark and yet were not to be found. Poor Tim would never understand echoes. They all went down underground again. And then, of course, they couldn't find the way to the wooden door. It was most tiresome.
"We shall lose our way all over again," said George desperately. "These dungeons are about the most rambling, spread-out maze of underground caves I've ever known. We shall lose the entrance again, too."
Julian had a bright idea. He had a piece of white chalk in his pocket, and he took it out. He went back to the steps and marked the wall there. Then he began to put chalk marks along the passages as they walked in the musty darkness. They came to the well, and Julian was pleased.
"Now," he said, "whenever we come to the well, we shall at least be able to find the way back to the steps, because we can follow my chalk marks. Now, the thing is, which is the way next? We'll try and find it, and I'll put chalk marks along the walls here and there. But if we go the wrong way and have to come back, we'll rub out the marks and start again from the well another way."
This was really a very good idea. They did go the wrong way and had to come back, rubbing out Julian's marks. They reached the well and set off in the opposite direction, and this time they did find the wooden door. There it was. Stout and sturdy, its old iron nails rusty and red. The children stared at it in delight. Julian lifted his axe. Crash! He drove it into the wood and round about the keyhole. But the wood was still strong, and the axe only went in an inch or two. Julian drove it in once more. The axe hit one of the big nails and slipped a little to one side. A big splinter of wood flew out and struck poor Dick on the cheek. He gave a yell of pain. Julian jumped in alarm and turned to look at him. Dick's cheek was pouring with blood.
"Something flew out of the door and hit me," said poor Dick. "It's a splinter or something."
"Golly," said Julian, and he shone his torch onto Dick. "Can you bear it a moment if I pull the splinter out? It's a big one, and it's still sticking into your poor cheek." But Dick pulled it out himself. He made a face with the pain, and then turned very white.
"You'd better get up into the open air for a bit," said Julian, "and we'll have to bathe your cheek and stop it bleeding somehow. Anne's got a clean hanky. We'll bathe it and dab it with that. We brought some water with us, luckily."
"I'll go with Dick," said Anne. "You stay here with George. There's no need for us all to go."
But Julian thought he would like to see Dick safely up into the open air first, and then he could leave him with Anne while he went back to George and went on with the smashing down of the door. He handed the axe to George.
"You can do a bit of chopping while I'm gone," he said. "It will take some time to smash that big door in. You get on with it, and I'll be down in a few minutes again. We can easily find the way to the entrance, because we've only got to follow my chalk marks."
"Right," said George. And she took the axe. "Poor old Dick, you do look a sight."
Leaving George behind with Tim, valiantly attacking the big door, Julian took Dick and Anne up to the open air. Anne dipped her hanky into the kettle of water and dabbed Dick's cheek gently. It was bleeding very much, as cheeks do, but the wound was not really very bad. Dick's colour soon came back, and he wanted to go down into the dungeons again.
"No, you better lie down on your back for a little," said Julian. "I know that's good for nose bleeding, and maybe it's good for cheek bleeding too. What about Anne and you going out on the rocks over there, where you can see the wreck, and staying there for half an hour or so? Come on, I'll take you both there and leave you for a bit. You'd better not get up till your cheeks stop bleeding, old boy."
End of Disc 3.